Demand with Jenna Ellis. I am your host, Jenna, and we are here at the American Family Radio Network with this exclusive podcast where you can tune in each and every Friday where we do a deeper dive into the issues that you want to hear about from the guests that you would like to hear from. And so, of course, this week, President Trump is celebrating 6 months of his second term, and the White House put out a great statement showcasing all of his significant wins for the Trump agenda. And how does that align with the Trump mandate that voters gave him and overall conservative priorities? And where is Congress in all this? Are they catching up, lagging behind, or too far behind? And where is this set to position us for the midterms? All of these things on the table this morning. So let's welcome in our guest, Dinesh D'Souza, who is the host of the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. You can find that on the Salem Media Network, and you can stream that wherever you find podcasts. I'd encourage you to subscribe to that podcast. He often has great guests, including me, of course. I'm probably his best guest. No, I'm kidding. But it's always great when he gets to join me as well. So Dinesh, my good friend, thanks so much. And you know, overall, how do you rate President Trump's first 6 months compared to the mandate that the voters gave him back in November?
Hey, Jenna. Great to be on the show. I think that Trump has done very vigorously and very well in the first 6 months. It's been, in some respects, quite turbulent because, as expected, there has been a lot of efforts to block, thwart, and interfere with what Trump is doing. I think it's wise that Trump has not tried to, you know, defend, has not tried to ignore judicial authority. He has generally appealed these cases, gone to the Court of Appeals, gone to the Supreme Court in some cases, and usually he wins in the end. So there is some slowing down of the Trump agenda, both in downsizing the government and deportations. But on the other hand, this is a guy who is trying to implement, I think, the ambitious program that he has outlined. And I think that when his supporters look to see what is pragmatically achievable, given the fact that we have a system based on checks and balances and so on, I think Trump is off to a really good start.
Yeah, and I think that's a really fair assessment. I mean, he started in office, of course, we remember, with signing over 200 executive orders and doing as much as he can to immediately on day one roll back some of the ridiculous Biden era agenda items. He granted pardons not only to the J6ers, but also to those who were unfairly prosecuted under the FACE Act, which should be repealed. I hope that that's on Congress's agenda. And so is doing as much as he can from the executive branch. Where do we fit DOGE into all of this? Because it seems like that kind of accountability. There was the One Big Beautiful Bill, obviously, that didn't put as much as Elon Musk, of course, would have preferred. But that was a really big agenda item that it seems like we're not really talking about anymore now.
Yeah, it looks like Trump has made a prudential decision to sideline the issue of dramatic budget cuts. Now, there are modest cuts that are going on all over the place. I mean, the essential termination of USAID, there's been a substantial scaling back at, say, the Department of Education. They had 4,000 employees, something like 1,500 of those people have been sent home. So there is an effort to pare back the size of the government. But that being said, battles over spending, I think, are very difficult because, of course, you have Republican elected officials, no less than Democrats, who benefit politically from handing out projects, goodies, benefits to their own district. And therefore, I would argue there is not a practical majority, either in the House or in the Senate, for substantial as opposed to cosmetic budget cuts. So I think Trump has digested this reality. Elon Musk is still sort of raging against it. I think he's annoyed that the Republicans haven't been sort of more willing to back him up. But I think the part of the problem here is the the structure of democratic politics in which politicians stay in office by granting favors in their own district, really by looting the treasury.
Yeah, and this goes in then to, you know, obviously some of his picks for those cabinet positions, like the Department of the Treasury, and then there's been a lot of, you know, focus on the economy and some of those things. What about the Bidenflation issues and the economic concerns that Americans rightly had, I think, with Trump? I mean, because when he left office in 2021, the economy had basically been decimated because of the whole COVID narrative. But heading into the so-called pandemic, the economy was booming, and everyone really wanted kind of a turnaround. And now are looking at either massively lowering taxes. There were some tax agenda issues in the One Big Beautiful Bill, but it actually eliminating federal income tax doesn't look like that's really a priority, at least of this Congress. But where are we at on the economy, the Treasury picks, and some of those economic issues?
I think Trump has two priorities here, and he's trying to do them simultaneously, and they're not the same. The first one is to shift opportunity, jobs, and resources toward a working class that has actually had it very tough for the past 30 years. This is a large demographic in the country, and it's a group of people of which it cannot be said that their lives are markedly better than their parents, or that their children's lives are going to be better than theirs. And this is really the almost the core meaning of the American dream, right? A kind of upward thrust for the economy. So I think Trump's very aware of that. And some of his policies, like tariffs and other things, even though they could be criticized on free market grounds, are aimed at helping this group, this demographic of people, almost like an issue of, you can always call it Republican social justice. The other side of it, I think, for Trump is to liberate the forces of economic growth. And I think for Trump, that means an explosion of energy production, bringing down energy prices, so making it easier to drill for oil and natural gas. It also means making permanent the Trump tax cuts, and that has been done in the Big Beautiful Bill. Finally, I think it means opening up new forms of technology, artificial intelligence, robotics, even Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. So Trump's idea is, let's put the United States in the forefront of, like, the frontier of global capitalism. And that's probably the area in which he's going to do the most good, so that if the economy, the pie itself, gets big enough, it is conceivable. This, I think, is Treasury Secretary Bessent's hope and plan, is that the size of the debt or the deficit relative to the pie is going to get smaller.
Yeah, and you mentioned, importantly, cryptocurrency and artificial intelligence, and there are a couple of key bills that are making their way through Congress right now. Where do you see this Congress and President Trump, and especially, I mean, this has been kind of a passion, if you will, of Vice President J.D. Vance in terms of ensuring that America is on the forefront of the regulation of artificial intelligence to make sure that that's done well globally. And so where in the tech industry is all of this going, and do you think that we'll see some good legislation on this?
I think with artificial intelligence, the main idea here is to watch out for some of the dangers and also prevent the AI from being so centralized that any group of people controls it, precisely because of its sort of terrifying power. So we don't want a situation similar to, you know, when we had three digital platforms controlling the whole space of public debate in this country. They imposed a joint regime of censorship in the aftermath of COVID and January 6th. And essentially, we had a suffocation of free speech debate in this country. I think with regard to cryptocurrencies, the basic idea here is that our banking system is very creaky and obsolete. I mean, Jenna, if you were to send a wire tomorrow, let's just say to a friend in Singapore, this wire would go through multiple banks. It would take many days. It would cost you would have a significant, you know, expense for being able to send that money. Now, imagine if you're able to use cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, or even these so-called stable coins. Essentially, you type in a computer code, you hit send, and at the fraction of the cost, sometimes in just pennies, you have an instant transaction, and it's not even a reversible transaction. The Bitcoin, for example, goes to Singapore. It's essentially in somebody else's vault. Done deal. So all of this is going to lubricate, I think, the channels of global commerce. And in general, it's a very good thing. It also undermines the centralized power of the Fed and of the federal government.
Mm. And let's turn, Dinesh, to the border as well. We've seen that, you know, the Supreme Court has been so far fairly friendly to President Trump in implementing his agenda. And, of course, Governor DeSantis with collaborating with DHS and opening Alligator Alcatraz as kind of this expeditious way to deport especially the most violent and criminals that are here illegally. And yet we're now seeing this so-called Dignity Act that bizarrely is actually sponsored by a Florida representative. And a lot of people are calling this amnesty. My understanding of that legislation is that it's providing at least a pathway to residency, not voting or any of that, for people who came in prior to the Biden administration, so have been here at least 5 years or longer as of the time that the legislation would pass. But the problem with that, of course, is that you know, then will just provide yet another gateway. And how can you prove how long someone has been here illegally? Because obviously they didn't come in and register. They don't have a stamp and a passport or anything like that. So there are problems, I think, implicit with that bill, even though there are Republicans that have signed on to that. So do we have a conflict in Congress over President Trump's mass deportation plan?
I think, Jenna, that it is not a conflict in principle, but it's a conflict of prudence and of priorities. You know, just reading an article this morning about this Dominican illegal who shot an off-duty Border Patrol agent while trying to rob him. And it noted in the article that in that single month where this guy in 2023, by the way, came into the United States illegally, 185,000 illegals crossed into this country in 1 month. So this is the kind of thing that drives people insane. And so there is, I think, a strong appetite here to send those illegals back. I'm talking about the illegals from the Biden years. These are people who were virtually dragged into this country. The motives for bringing them here are purely nefarious. It's not, of course, all the fault of the illegals, because, as I say, there was a kind of open invitation of them to come from the Biden regime. So I think there needs to be an aggressive plan in place to send those people back. And that's why I think that the Salazar bill is sort of ill-timed, because it's almost like you've just been a victim of a home invasion that's been, you know, going on, let's just say, for weeks. And then somebody comes along with like a prison rehabilitation for home invaders. It's like, it's not that you're against that, but like, this is the wrong time. The focus here needs to be on sending the Biden illegals home. So Trump has secured the border. That's part one. Sending the Biden illegals home needs to be an essential sort of part two of that immigration policy.
Yeah, and that completely makes sense, and it is a matter of a priority. So, you know, then let's fast forward to the midterms. There is concern amid the Epstein documents controversy, which seems to be, in my opinion, Dinesh, just a really bad PR move on the part of Pam Bondi. And then Trump kind of inexplicably came out and said, well, we just shouldn't care about it now, even though that was one of the promises that he made during the campaign. And I think that if Pam Bondi had either just stayed quiet and waited to review all the evidence, they didn't have all of that, you know, influencer Bindergate nonsense, then this could have been rolled out a lot more effectively. Or if she just came forward now and said, you know, listen, we're doing everything we can, but there are court orders in place that prevent some of this from being released. And of course, we have to abide by those, but we're going to make every effort, you know, that kind of thing. Rather than it seeming like there are that both administrations, Trump and Biden, might have been protecting, you know, some of these powerful players in Washington, because that's the perception. And so, so what do you make of that? And, you know, is all of that kind of diminishing from the 6 months and now having kind of an impact as we're heading into, kind of the runway into the midterms?
You know, I think with regard to the Epstein thing, because it was suppressed for a long time, people's imaginations went into a full kind of galloping mode. And there were things that were added to what we know about Epstein, or where we have very reasonable suspicions. And on top of that, people developed all kinds of kind of wacky theories. So, for example, you know, the idea that somehow Epstein was running a paid prostitution ring where, like, okay, Bill Gates, you know what, you didn't send in your $10,000 check. I mean, there's no evidence that that was going on. Even the evidence of Epstein's involvement with intelligence agencies, when we think about it, there's a suspicion there, but there's no thread that links him to, let's say, Mossad or even to U.S. intelligence agencies in any clear way. Now, that there were rich and powerful people flying to the Epstein Island, that's a fact. That there are highly suspicious circumstances surrounding Epstein's death, that's a fact. And so I think that the Trump administration has done a really poor job here of just saying, hey, listen, this is what we know. We're being very forthright about all this. There are people whose names are either in the files or, quite frankly, Trump, there may be an element of truth to what Trump says when he says that the Biden administration, like, doctored the files, in which case he needs to say that and say, listen, there's a lot of unreliable information in there because, as with Russia collusion and so on, these people have essentially manipulated the database or manipulated the files. The files are obviously not like, you know, manila folder files. They're quite likely to be ultimately digital files, which are susceptible to being manipulated. But yes, I agree. I think this is created a wall of suspicion between the Trump administration and some of its most ardent supporters.
Yeah, and I fully agree with that perspective as well. And it's kind of mind-boggling to me that Pam Bondi didn't, because she's no stranger to media. I mean, she's very prolific. She's, you know, gone on national cable news for a long time. And so she's no stranger to optics and understanding the PR. And so the fact that she got ahead of this really quickly when she first took office, it seems like it might have been a better course of action to just, you know, get her feet wet, kind of see the landscape before going out fairly quickly and, you know, making some of these promises and saying some things that were contained that on her desk that now that may not necessarily be an accurate assessment. And if that's the case, she just needs to be forthcoming with that. And I think at least the MAGA base would accept that and would be forgiving as well. I mean, because that makes sense and everybody could understand that. It's more of the being told that, you know, hey, you shouldn't care about this topic anymore. Don't care about the accountability, the draining the swamp and the protecting of, you know, the deep state actors and all of this that we've all cared about since before President Trump took office the first time. I mean, that was a huge reason. The whole drain the swamp campaign in 2016 was a huge reason he first got elected. So how much does all of this, as well as, you know, maybe a little bit of lag on the part of Congress and some of that disjointed, you know, they're not fully in lockstep with President Trump, even though Speaker Johnson has been way more supportive than, of course, former Speaker Paul Ryan in the first trifecta of Trump's first term. How much of this do you think will affect the midterms, because there's, you know, always talk about, you know, it's going to be really difficult for Republicans to maintain the majority and predictions of whether they'll lose either the House or the Senate. Where do you see the landscape, at least at this moment in time?
I do think that Mike Johnson, you know, a decent guy, is nevertheless very beholden to Trump He's not a strong leader. And so the only way he gets anything through is he polls the Republican base. He's always short of votes. And then basically Trump has to call the holdouts and have a combination of carrots and sticks to get those guys to fall into line. So the weird fact is that Trump is actually currently running not just the executive branch, but also the legislative branch, in the sense that he's the only person right now who can get anything across the finish line. That's, by the way, how the Big Beautiful Bill got done. With regard to Epstein, I think Trump is also partly at fault here, although I do understand his irritation. I think the way Trump is looking at it is that there are big specific things in front of us that the Republican base can be really helpful on. So, for example, right now, the whole issue of the culpability of people like Clapper and Brennan and Comey and even Obama, I mean, that is a huge issue. So if we're focused on Epstein, which is something that basically occurred in the 1990s and was, you know, done by like 2005, you know, a decade before Trump even got office in his first term, I think Trump's view is like we're losing sight of what we should be focusing on. So I agree with Trump with regard to priorities. But of course, the misfortune has been that the more he has been irritable and dismissive, the more the issue has become enlarged, and it's also emboldened the never Trumpers and the Democrats. This is the most exciting thing to happen to them really in the last 6 months.
Well, and so just the last 2 minutes I have with you, Dinesh, I know this has been, you know, kind of quick punches all around on, you know, where we've been, but let's talk about then where we're headed in terms of the next 6 months, because hopefully Trump will get past some of this negative PR and just go back to, you know, the fake news that he's always dealt with, and really lay some solid groundwork and get the ball rolling in terms of momentum for the midterms. What would you like to see on a wish list of conservative priorities for the next 6 months from both the administration and Congress?
Well, I think that the anxiety about the midterms is really premature, because the midterms are going to be decided by primarily the economic condition in the country between about April and September, or April and October of next year. So Trump needs to make sure that the economic structures are in place for the country to be in a kind of boom at that point. If we think back, you know, to the Reagan years, Reagan had a very difficult second year. And in fact, Reagan didn't time it all that well. He had a very bad midterm in 1982, but the economy came roaring back in 1983. And then the 1984 election, I mean, you didn't even need to have it because he was so far ahead and ended up winning 49 states. So the key thing here is not only to have an economic recovery, but have it timed right. And if Trump's economic policies work, I don't think that he's going to have to worry that, like, the issue of Epstein or any of these other issues are going to somehow thwart Republican success in the midterms.
All right. Well, Dinesh D'Souza, I really appreciate your time, and what a great series of responses and discussion on all of the priorities and the conservative goals. And so, as always, as Christians, we need to be praying for those in office, and that there would be even more headway in terms of advancing that mandate, because we want our government to do what is in the best interest of the American people. And I think that was a huge a part of where the voters back in November really looked between Donald Trump versus Kamala Harris. I mean, the world view could not be more different in terms of that contrast. It was a pivotal moment of where is America going. And so just last question for you, Dinesh. I really do see kind of a cultural shift in all of this because of the Trump mandate. You know, we're seeing the rollback of DEI, and also when President Trump said, okay, the federal government is only going to recognize two genders, male and female, and that's immutable. I mean, that's such an obvious but really good thing. I really do see that there is a cultural shift taking place in a very good way. How do you see that and where we're going over the next, not just the next 6 months, but the next 3.5 years for the betterment of America culturally?
I think that this is a critical point, which is that our culture has been in a sort of free fall. And some of that has economic roots. I mean, communities, for example, which become decimated with regard to jobs, all kinds of cultural pathologies come out of that. But the structure of the family, the condition of marriage, the wholesale neglect of children that has occurred over the past generation or two, all of this is now, I think, producing a massive reassessment by young people. And I'm actually startled to see that there are many young people today who are, you know, far to the right of me, and far to the right of me even when I was their age. And this is a kind of neo-traditionalism. Some people call it, the trad culture. It's occurring both within and outside the Christian community. There's some like talk of restoring some form of patriarchy. I mean, all of this, some of it is a little out of control, but it's healthy in the sense that what it reflects is a real cultural reevaluation of the deleterious and destructive effects of things like feminism and the LGBTQ culture of really the last 30 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can only hope that this is really a turning point for not only just freedom and liberty in a lot of these ways, but culturally, that the next generation and the young people who are going to be an even bigger voting block in the next election, the next presidential election, are going to start turning back to reality. I mean, just common sense, and none of this ridiculous woke nonsense and the lies of the left that have been, you know, part of the sexual revolution and feminism for the last 50 and 60 years. I mean, all of those things. But we need to turn back to God, and we need to ensure that, you know, the church is taking a bold stand as well. But Dinesh, really appreciate your commentary, and let people know where they can subscribe to your podcast, The Dinesh D'Souza Show, where you daily have a really amazing commentary and excellent guests.
Hey, thanks, Jenna. It's been a pleasure. My podcast is in audio at Google and Spotify, and it's in video on YouTube and Rumble.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And that is all the time that we have for On Demand. And as always, if you have an issue, a topic, or a guest that you would like to talk about or hear from, then you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net. We'll see you on demand next Friday.